Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Dan Payne, an actor you may have seen in Alice, I Think, Watchmen, Strange Empire, or The Cabin in the Woods. He recently appeared in DC's Legends of Tomorrow as the Justice Society hero Obsidian, and he plays Wadjet, the security officer to Idris Elba's villainous Krall, in Justin Lin's Star Trek Beyond, released on Blu-ray and DVD just last week. Dan picked Seven Psychopaths, Martin McDonagh's 2012 comedy of errors about a screenwriter named Marty, played by Colin Farrell, who finds himself distracted from an epic case of writer's block when he's embroiled in a complex web of crime involving multiple murders, gangsters, and a stolen dog. With a cast that includes Sam Rockwell, Christopher Walken, Woody Harrelson, Gabourey Sidibe, Olga Kurylenko, Harry Dean Stanton, and Abby Cornish, it's a caper movie like few others, even if it feels like it's like a lot of them. Oh, incidentally, the title of the play that I can't remember 2 minutes into the conversation is A Behanding in Spokane. This is someone else's movie.
Character, character, character. I love certain actors transform, and it doesn't matter what they do, they transform and take you on almost a molecular level to the character and the mentality and the mind frame and the demeanor and the, I mean, all those words I came up for, but I use them because they matter. If you create a full and complete character, then we go with you. We go on the ride with you. And that means flaws too, like to be flawed, but in a way that is specific to the character, the environment, and who that person is. And Sam Rockwell is, I find him intoxicating that way. Like, he's a genius.
Yeah.
To play the the character in Seven Psychopaths with the quirks and the demented twists that he had, but with, like, they were, it was normal for him.
Yeah.
That was just life.
Yeah, he manages to make all the layering seem effortless
and free of judgment. You know, he never judged it, so we don't.
Yeah.
And then you watch it and you're like, I should be judging that. My moral fiber is telling me that's not right.
Yeah.
And Woody Harrelson, I think he's getting better and better. Every film he does, he seems to be finding a new and deeper way to present his characters.
Yeah. It's amazing. And
Christopher Walken's a classic. I mean, yeah. There's just...
I was going to say, what amazes me the most about the film is how tightly scripted it is and how cast it is. It's not that he wrote
it. Cast, right? Like, yeah. it was that.
He didn't write it for those people, though. I mean, I interviewed Rockwell and Walken together at TIFF that year, which is like one of the greatest 20 minutes I've ever had.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, because I just wanted to ask Rockwell about Galaxy Quest.
Yeah.
And Walken's like, what's that? And so Rockwell starts telling him the entire story of Galaxy Quest, acting out all the parts in the space of 3 minutes. And I'm like, this is the best day. Whatever else happens, this is the best day. And Rockwell said that he and Walken had done a play for McDonagh. They'd done one of his plays, A Behanding. And of course, the title just flew out of my hand. But it's the one with Behanding in it. And so McDonagh approached them for the roles. But I don't think he had planned on casting anybody else. But everybody in it is perfectly cast.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the script existed before that. He wasn't writing to them. And there was very little improv.
To me, that pays respect to both the writing and the people cast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it proves that you can have great writing and it will translate if you hire talented people. I mean, sometimes you take amazing cast members and they improve on the writing, or they take the character to a whole other level because of their talent. But that's... There was something about Seven Psychopaths, and I found it to be an intelligent movie. It had so much to say and so much subtlety and so many layers, but you didn't have to fill in the blanks. Like, I like to watch something, don't get me wrong, I like to drool on myself when I'm watching TV and just be completely taken on a ride and not have to be present, hardly. Especially with comedies, I love to laugh. I love the relax and the escapist notion of just having a good time and letting go.
Sure.
But Seven Psychopaths, I felt like I was so carried on that journey by their performances, by the tight script, that it was effortless. I got to watch it. It was an effortless watch. And then I was I don't know, we're inspired by those performances to find that level of for lack of a better word, in to their characters.
Right.
That when they injected themselves into that world, it was complete. When it's not complete, our brain has to fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
And a lot of movies, I don't know if they get released too soon or they don't get enough drafts, or you can't get the person you ideally want for the role, but they get somebody who's really talented, and then you... It's like that weird writing thing, like if you see two ands, if it's put in a certain way, your brain just skips over the second and.
Yeah.
I think when we're watching, if there's gaps in a movie, if it's good enough, or if we want to enjoy it enough, that we fill in the blanks and we skip the gaps. And what I loved about Seven Psychopaths is that I could almost sit there like the Drool on Myself version, because I was so deftly carried through the whole thing that I could just experience it for its awesomeness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then at the end of it, be blown away by how okay I was with the demented aspects and the twisted notion of, yeah.
It takes you to some place. I mean, it tells you it's going to go there. That's the thing that I really
unapologetically
love about what McDonagh does. He doesn't pretend that he is creating high art, but he actually is. That he makes no pretense.
For everybody. It's...
And then says, you know, like, don't be so shocked. We knew this was going to happen. This is always where this story was going to go. It wasn't going to end. I mean, it does end happily, but it wasn't going to end triumphantly necessarily.
Right.
We opened with this long single take where two people are just randomly murdered, except that it isn't. And then there's a reason. And just that great opening sequence that has really nothing to do with the rest of the film, except that it does. It's that Tarantino trick. I think that's
the
why
tone,
he gets exactly. He's tonally luring you.
Yeah, it's a lure. It's a great. I'm glad we're talking about this film, and I've chose this film because, as much as I've loved it, I've never really processed it.
Okay,
you know, so I've known that Sam Rockwell and Woody Harrelson and Walken and all of those guys did their job to a level where I'm like, I want to get to a place in my game where I can. Where I can do that. That's the level of performance and professionalism and all the aspects that make that performance that great. I want to find those in my own game, so that if I'm ever called on for that depth or that level of care. Oh no, actually no. For everything and anything I do, let's be honest. Anytime I'm ever on camera, I want to be able to find the complete, absolute, the completeness and the fullness of that character. But I never really processed it. I just appreciated it for its entirety.
Well, I think that's perfectly fine, too. I mean, there's nothing that says you need to pick a movie apart and deconstruct it.
The Matrix made me.
Oh, yeah.
The Matrix made me deconstruct my perspective on life and what does and doesn't matter and how we operate. And are we missing something, and am I living my life properly, or am I a battery, or, you know, like... Mm-hmm. That one made me think, and it wasn't so much about the movie, except for I was grateful it was done well enough. It was done very well. Mm-hmm. But I went away thinking about the...
So the metaphor is what...
Yeah, that's what... So I read the book, you know, which pill would you... You know,
right.
I read the book, because... And it was no longer about the movie, per se. Whereas Seven Psychopaths, I'm addicted to the movie.
Yeah.
I'm addicted to the high art, the story, the characters, the performance. I want to watch the movie again. The Matrix, I don't need to watch it so much again, because it asked the questions and it caused me to delve into that dialogue, that rhetoric.
It was your inciting incident. Like, you could go out from it.
Exactly. But, thank you, yes.
Yeah. But Seven Psychopaths is more like a toy. I mean, it's just there to be played with. It doesn't have any secrets inside. It's just so much fun to play with the puzzle.
But every time you look at the toy... Oh, there's a new angle to the... there's something...
Yeah.
It is so full that every time I watch it, I get another rise. I get another experience from it.
Well, it is this kind of remarkable serpentine narrative of three narrative frames. There's the thing that is the screenplay, there's the person writing the screenplay, and then there's the adventure that happens around the person writing the thing. But... Where, I mean, it seems like it's only two things, but I think there is a third level. I think that the audience's engagement, that our awareness that we are watching a piece of created narrative, is the third thing. And that's like the fun new layer that you get to play with that most movies leave out.
Yeah.
Because they're there to be consumed, and they don't count on you. You know, Christopher Nolan does it in The Prestige, but he does it with that big thumb on the scale kind of thing. Like, are you watching closely? Are you sure you're seeing this?
Yeah, to ask. It's like the wink. You know, like in comedy, sometimes... the wink helps the comedy, and sometimes it steals the laughter.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, if you sometimes if you wink, you're laughing for us, and then we don't get to laugh.
Yeah. Well, it's the difference between making a reference and actually crafting a moment.
Right? Yeah. Like, no, I'm not taking anything away from Prestige, but.
Oh yeah, no. It simply is telling you that there's a structure that you have to pay attention to, and Seven Psychopaths just starts.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's always more fun.
I think
an hour into the movie to sort of be hit with this realization that, oh, this is also this. Like, that's fun.
Yeah.
The Guest is the one that I make an example of. The Adam Wingard and Simon Barrett thriller from a couple of years back with Dan Stevens and Micah Monroe. The whole movie sets itself up as this fun little homage to John Carpenter movies, but then around 80 minutes in, it tells you exactly which John Carpenter movie it is, and it's so much fun to just have that moment land.
Yeah.
And you know, like, you either get it instantly and you're giggling, or it still works as what it is.
Which well, that's is, the craft. Like, yeah, there's a great movie. Craft. Yeah, that's well crafted. That if you don't get it, you still get the ride.
Yeah, but I love it when movies do that. And Seven Psychopaths has a way of sort of beguiling you with all these eccentric performances and all these characters. And what's Tom Waits doing with the rabbit? And why is that happening? And all this stuff is flying back and forth. And then every now and then, it will just hit you with this hook of. It's not even a hook. I don't know what it is. It's like a button hook where two things become stitched into one thing.
It's like a... I mean, you know, the human... For me, the human... Like, it's like a
boxing stuff. Yeah, yeah.
And you're dodging all the jabs because, you know, like, I can't... I shouldn't... Oh, and then you just don't see the hit coming. And then you're like, oh, okay, you got me. You tagged me. I get it.
So what was your first experience of it? Did you see it in the theater? Did you catch up to it on disc?
I caught up to it on disc. And it was... I think we started talking about this... I don't even have cable. Okay. I know that probably sounds weird for an actor, but I don't have cable. I have Netflix for my kids, and then after that, I want to read a book or watch a movie because I'm intrigued by either seeing a trailer or hearing about it, or a friend goes, hey, have you seen this movie? You gotta see this movie. And then we talk about it. And not that I, you know, there's been times when I have higher expectations, and that's probably not the best way to go into it, because then it doesn't maybe meet them quite as well, but a great movie is a great movie. And a friend of mine said, you've got to watch this movie. I think you'd love it. You keep telling me about how performances and characters and all this. I think this will tweak that for you. So I rented it and watched it. And even with high expectations, it met and surpassed them because it is that good in my mind. So yeah, I watched it on DVD. And my wife and I have different tastes in movies. So I watched this movie and I was like, honey, you've got to watch this movie. It is perfection. It is, oh yeah, you know, I'm spewing about it. And she's like, okay. And I watched it and she goes, yeah, it was good. It was weird. Kind of off in a weird way. And I'm like, yeah, but isn't that, wasn't it beautiful? Like, wasn't, yeah, I guess. I mean, she's not an actor, so that we watch for different reasons, right, so as does everyone.
Yeah, the industry stuff wouldn't land the same way. Or
right. Which is fine, and she could respect, she did feel the same about the performances. She's like, those were some brilliant performances. But yeah, it's just neat to see, you know, for me, even my wife, the one person whose opinion would matter most in the world to me, watches this movie, and I'm like, here it is, this is the pinnacle of movies right now for me. And she's like, yeah, it's pretty good. You're like, what? It's more than pretty good, you know? So it was interesting to have a different perception than it, but the movie, again, to harp on it, was so good that I'm like, I wonder why she said that. I'm going to watch it again. You know, I'm gonna dig into it and see. And then, you find another part of the toy that was really cool to play with.
It is, it's a hard film, I found, to describe, because the title makes people expect a horror movie, basically.
Right.
The first sequence, the opening, makes you expect a Tarantino movie, and it's not going to do that either. It just it is so it's so aggressive,
it's
about
always
refusing to be
you slightly off balance, which is amazingly fun.
Yeah, and the other bit, the thing that didn't land for me at all because I hadn't watched Boardwalk Empire yet, is that Michael Stuhlbarg and Michael Pitt are in the opening scene, and that just only really lands if you've seen them on the show. And
see, there's something I did.
They're just interesting actors who I like.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you go and revisit, or you discover Boardwalk Empire. It's like, oh, okay, those two shouldn't be together at all. That doesn't make sense. Those worlds are colliding.
Right.
And that, again, that's a nested joke that's only there for people.
And that's one I didn't get, so I have to go watch it again.
It's something. It's all those little playful gestures. It's the sort of thing that McDonough does. I think he's in the moment just like, oh, I'll put these two together, that'll be funny. And then we're stuck with them, and it informed that little relationship then informs the scene in a way that it didn't before, even on the page.
You think it's on the, like, you think it's a, that happenstance, or do you think it's a extremely well thought out?
I think, I mean, you never know, right? It might have been that he cast one and they recommended the other.
Yeah, true.
But those weird little decisions that have to be random because you can't guarantee,
like lightning start, in a bottle, I guess.
Yeah, if you start writing that scene, it's like, I'm only going to shoot this if Michael Pitt and Michael Stuhlbarg
are together.
You can't be sure, right? We know he wanted Rockwell and Walken, but what if he didn't want them for those roles necessarily? What if he just wanted to find a space for
them? Or they read it like Rockwell reads it and goes, no, I want to be Woody's character.
Yeah.
Then the whole thing flips.
Exactly. It's after, well, you'd seen in Bruges already, I assume.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Because then
you start going up there, yeah.
Yeah, so you sort of know what to expect, right? You have a general idea.
Oh my God.
Of what he'll do. But his film work.
Oh, that's
so,
a phenomenal movie as well.
Please, no.
Well, just the. So that was one where my dad and I connected and laughed wholeheartedly and loved every moment of, like, and a bit obscure and a bit offside and.
Mm-hmm. Because that thing came out of nowhere. I mean, nobody.
Oh my goodness!
It just, yeah, it just burped into existence. It was this movie from. I mean, I remember when the word first started rumbling around film festivals. It's like a movie from this playwright that you've never heard of was how it was sold to me. And
yeah,
like, okay, what do you got? And it's just this strange, angry. It does feel more like a Tarantino riff than Seven Psychopaths does.
Yeah, it does.
But I think
more.
It's just because you're in this world of criminals on the run all the time, which is essentially Reservoir Dogs. So yeah, you can't get away from it. But, you know.
But, and the Brandy, quick-witted banter. And
yeah. And the younger and older thing. I mean, it's Mr. White and Mr. Orange. You can if you look, because tropes work that way, you can find them.
But, yeah, true, of course.
But what Gleason is doing and what Farrell is doing and then finds, it's just so much. It's so specifically European and it's so pissy in a really unique way.
But in a way that, yeah, it was it's funny that came up because I absolutely love that movie too. But so it's European and pissy, but it's not. So I lived in London for 5 years, and I feel like the UK or the English sense of humor. I quite like Ricky Gervais. I think is absolutely brilliant, and there's a universal nature to his funny. But there's also a very British aspect to it. But that film, albeit set in that world, doesn't exclude any audience from that. Mm-hmm. Like somehow it brings you in, and you feel like you know it.
Right.
For me.
Absolutely. By the end of the film, you're completely lived in the world. You're sympathetic to everybody.
Exactly. And if you've never lived in that world, it's not like at the end of it, you're like, oh, I didn't quite get it because I'm not from there. I don't know that cultural thing. He did really well to bring us all in on it.
And we've all felt weirdly out of place in crappy hotels, I think, at least once in our lives.
Yeah.
Then you pile on the extra stuff.
Oh,
and they're dealing with some issues. But even that didn't. Like, it doesn't really show you the way into Seven Psychopaths, because Seven Psychopaths is so much more sophisticated in its narrative. I mean, it's got stuff going on on multiple levels. In Bruges, people with a secret. You can boil it down to that.
And it's somewhat linear.
Yeah, it's a straight line.
Yeah, so you don't have to follow the bouncing ball.
Yeah.
Duck and dodge. And...
Yeah. Whereas, yes, you're using the boxing metaphor. It's like boxing inside a tilt-a-whirl. Seven Psychopaths is how I can figure it.
Yeah, you're never balanced. But that's the beauty of it. Mm-hmm. I like going on that ride. And I don't mind. So my wife makes fun of me because I'm a hockey fanatic. And when I watch hockey, she says it looks like I'm in a coma with my eyes open because I'm like staring and mouth half open and just until there's something, and then I get it, and then back to a coma. But with that movie, she said I had this weird half grin and I was completely engaged and present, which can tell me personally as a viewer, like, I was engaged to a level where, so hockey I can disconnect and engage. I mean, it's so strange to say, but I can connect so much to the hockey that I physically disengage.
Okay.
But Seven Psychopaths, my brain, my body, my mind, I was right there because of the boxing and the tilt-a-whirl aspect, which I loved.
So did multiple viewings make it, like, so close together, did it help you process it, or was it just the same kind of glee every time?
The glee definitely won out every time. Like, every time I was like, that is just an awesome movie. But a little different aspect. So I'd follow one. Sam Rockwell's performance was the first and foremost in
right.
for me. And then the next time I watched it, I definitely watched Woody Harrelson and Christopher Walken more, because I felt so like I had fallen in love with Sam Rockwell's performance that I wanted to see, that I got caught watching mostly him. You know, you might
right,
see yeah. what I did or didn't miss by being so focused on Sam Rockwell's performance. And then the last one, I just tried to see how many, like if I could be more balanced in the tilt-a-whirl yeah. while trying to box. And that's why this is a great conversation for me, is just to process in here out loud more of the thoughts that I may or may not be having. I'm shaping as we talk. Right. Which is great.
We're happy to provide the service. yeah, for me, I was amazed watching it the last time. I haven't seen it in a while, but the last time I watched it, I was surprised at how present Colin Farrell is, because I had almost forgotten he was in it. He's the lead, basically. He is the storyteller. But he recedes so quickly because he's the straight man, and everybody else is so much bigger and weirder and wilder.
Which, you know, I think some people think that Colin Farrell has huge ego, but some I've heard.
Okay,
I don't know. I mean, I don't know firsthand. I think he's just a phenomenally talented guy. But
only met him once. He was very gracious.
Yeah, he yeah. seems so. Anyway, and when I watched that film, one of the times I watched that film, like you can't do what he did and have an ego. He did exactly what he needed to do to let the story be told in such an immaculate way that any ego would have ruined that.
Yeah, he can't be the center of a scene.
You can't steal anything. You can't take anything, because it will take away from something else and therefore detract from the overall.
Yeah.
And he didn't in any way, shape, or form. Which is either an expression of the fact that people are full of crap and they think he has an ego, or it just speaks to his amazing talent.
Yeah.
Because if he does have an ego, he definitely knows how to be a professional.
Yeah.
Not only talented professional.
It's a weird... Yeah, I've never understood the amount of projection that goes... I mean, I understand it. I see how it works. But the way that people project, the whole point of actors is that we can, you know, we experience them as our avatars. We can be, but we can root for
they're
them.
They're our audience and the avatar. And
Yeah. But then people saying, oh, that guy's stuck up. It's like, where do you make those decisions? And why does it even matter? Why does it enter into something? It's just this whole...
Yeah, all it's, the it's shots so irrelevant.
Yeah, and the way it becomes toxic and how... You know, the Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie thing happened last month and people were gleeful about it. And it's like, it's still a family breaking up. But I don't see the point of...
Yeah, there's nothing great about it.
Yeah, the
clip. Oh, yeah, Jennifer finally gets her revenge.
Yeah.
What?
And why are we still thinking about that?
20 years later?
Exactly.
Whatever, give me a break. But yeah, there's some strange... Well, the industry itself is strange.
Sure.
I think some of the beauty is born out of the strange. But then it also, you know, for every yin, there's a yang, so... Mm-hmm. Yeah. So another movie that intrigued me that was almost on my that I almost threw at you was Donnie Darko. Do you?
Okay, yeah, sure.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
Movie? It's a way back, but it's in a similar kind of off kilter and offbeat, and there's a uniqueness to it that I was intoxicated by. And I'm wondering now that I've got what I feel like is your expertise in front of me, is there's got to be, I think there's some Seven Psychopaths and the Donnie Darko world.
Mm.
There were some similarities to me in the experience.
Yeah,
I'll say.
That's interesting. I mean, they're both sort of stylized narratives that depend on the viewer to understand what's going on inside them, right? I mean, they're analytical movies, even though they don't think they are, or they don't present themselves that way.
Yeah.
So maybe that's it. It's just the way you feel watching them is similar because you're.
But this, yeah, there's something. Into them. I think there's something about the. Wow, we're going to start getting deeper.
Yeah, go for it.
For me, everything in life matters. That matters is based on connection.
Mm-hmm.
So in my relationship with my wife, I work on the connection I have as a husband and wife. And the connection to my kids is as a father and a son, and how to be the best and most connected and present I can be. So Seven Psychopaths, their performances and the story and the narrative, like... It was so easy to connect so completely and go fully on the ride that's what was engaging about it, and that's why I think I sat there with such presence versus just spoon-feed me.
Right, so you've plugged right in.
Yeah, being plugged in. I want to be plugged into... this might sound a little flaky or... Yeah. Hey, I'm West Coast, I'm Vancouver, what can I say? But being plugged in and being connected is what matters most. So Donnie Darko, something about that movie, I was completely present and plugged in mm-hmm. to that whole from the start of the film to the end of the film and beyond. Because if I keep talking about it afterwards, there's still some connection, some level of being plugged into it. And that's what Seven Psychopaths, I've never fully unplugged from it. Whereas a ton of movies that I've watched, I've enjoyed with exquisite joy and then unplug completely and it doesn't happen. Or I don't plug in a way that makes me, challenges me or causes me to, like Matrix, ask questions and dive into some rhetoric after sure. the fact. I go for the ride and I enjoy it and then I'm out. And that level of connection and plug in, let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, can be anywhere. If I still enjoy it, it can still be a, you know, people say it. And anyway, Donnie Darko and Seven Psychopaths, and I don't know why they came up, but the plug-in was a 10 out of 10 and it stayed.
Interesting. Well, for me, the experience of Donnie Darko was so laden with dread. Like, it's just it's a film that is constantly telling you something terrible is coming. And it is. Like, that's the narrative. That's mm-hmm. the whole point. And it's got that weird button hook with The Last Temptation of Christ about how, you know, the whole point of it is, to my mind, is at least in the theatrical cut, because I refuse to acknowledge the director's cut, it makes everything worse. It mucks up the theory and the time travel.
Yeah, yeah.
The theatrical cut, the 2-hour version of Donnie Darko, is this really fascinating passion story about a kid who saves the world, or at least his town, by choosing to die.
Yeah.
Whether he knows he's doing it or not, whether there's a control mechanism or not, whatever else is going on in the world, that's how I connect to it. It's a martyrdom story, but it's a really moving, weird one. And to the point where it gets fuzzy logically, I feel like I failed the movie rather than the other way around, because it seems to know what it's doing so clearly.
Right. Yes.
Then you get to the theatrical, then you get to the director's cut, and it's like, oh, I see, you were actually made your movie better by yanking stuff out of it that now complicates my interpretation of it, so I refuse to accept it.
Right, which may be the difference of... Yeah, it's cool that you say that.
I think it's the sense of confidence that the movie has, that it knows what it's doing, and then if...
Which allows you to be confident with it. It's like anything. You know, when I played pro sports, when the team was confident, or our captain was confident, or our coach was confident, that confidence is infectious. It's contagious. Infectious sounds negative. It's contagious, which maybe could be negative. But and if everyone buys in, then there's a success that can be had. And that's, I think, exactly what you said with Donnie Darko. It was confident in its storytelling in the theatrical release, and you go for that. And if you don't feel something, you feel like you have to look deeper, or you have to figure out where it is that you don't understand what went on.
Seven Psychopaths was the same way. It just starts off with such authority in that prologue that says, look, you know, this is where we're going. You don't have to come, but this is where the movie is going.
If you're coming on the ride, here's the jumping off point.
I mean, you can say, like, the Transformers movies are confident, but they're garbage. I don't care for 10 seconds of any of those.
Yeah, but, yeah, it's pop.
Yeah, there's good pop, there's bad pop, but there's this sense that, like, in those movies, they are so clearly not for me. Like, they don't care about my experience. That sounds dumb, because no movie can care about the audience, but... Yeah, like I know where you're going.
I think.
But with things like Donnie Darko, definitely with McDonough's films, they depend on an engaged audience. He needs you to pay attention.
That's what makes me. That's what draws me to them. I think there's a place for Transformers. I mean, obviously. Well, but obviously there is. It makes a lot of money and stuff.
Sure.
And I think a lot of people sometimes totally want to check out.
Yeah.
And not plug in at all. I mean, as I said, connections. I'm all about that.
Yeah.
But I'll sit through a completely brain dead, you know, go for a ride movie that has zero to say, and it's just all effects or action, or because life isn't easy.
Sure.
And there's got to be times when, I mean, that's why we go have a beer now again with our friends, just check out.
Yeah, but you're still having a conversation, right? Like, you're enjoying.
Yeah, versus just yelling at each other.
Yeah. I mean, that's fun too. About 2 hours in, that gets there.
It's better if there's a hockey game in front of you.
Exactly. But then, like, that's the communal interaction. The experience of being in a bar with your friends, and even being in a bar alone, you're still part of it in a weird way. You're like a cell in an organism.
Yeah.
But, the type of entertainment, I find myself now, like, gravitating to movies that at least want, like, they don't want me to turn off my entire brain, or they're performed or they're constructed with some kind of wit and intelligence. I'm trying to think of the last big mass market. I just saw Doctor Strange, which is ridiculously intelligent in its entertainment, in a way that few Marvel movies have been, which actually gives you hope for the whole enterprise. It's like it basically exists without any of the other films. It's not weighed down by the baggage. You don't have to know what S.H.I.E.L.D. is or what this is or what the piece fits. And you can just watch an origin story that is kind of fun and inventive. Plus, I have never liked anything the director has made, so this was a really nice surprise. Scott Derrickson, the guy who made The Exorcism of Emily Rose and Deliver Us from Evil, they're fine, but they're just not for me. They're not the kind of movie that I enjoy.
Yeah, no.
And this is a film that plays with, well, he has power over time and space, so let's play with space and time as action sequence motivators. Let's do something different. And that plus the character work that they do, there's a moment
that's Cumberbatch.
Benedict Cumberbatch, yeah. But there's a moment where Tilda Swinton just says, great, I think, or great or grand or something. And she just follows it with this incredibly phony smile that says so much about her character and how weird and awkward this entire movie is. It's just like, I'm in. You got me. Where are we going to go?
Wow, cool.
And, you know, I've got this giant poster of Star Trek Beyond in my eyeline. That was the most rewarding feeling this summer, was realizing that someone had made a 2-hour episode of the original series with the scale, with the intelligence, and that, you know,
it was a 2-hour episode.
It's what I didn't know I needed, because we've been spending all this time on the grandeur of the series, and the first two films are so rooted in the Wrath of Khan trilogy thing, and they're not bad. I love them all.
They're all great, but I love the direction these went.
Yeah, it's like, hey, remember, we have individuals. Like, this is a story about a bunch of people who are a crew. Let's follow that.
We get to have separate experiences with Simon Pegg penned it too.
Yeah,
which is, I don't know. And I trust him
implicitly now at this point.
Yeah, right. And I don't know how much was collaborative or how much he went, you know, we got to get back to this. The core of what works for this legacy, legendary franchise. Because I feel like they've gone, the direction that they're going is in the right vein of what hopefully the next installment.
Yeah. Well, two and a half years ago.
Which is with Chris Hemsworth?
Yeah. Bring him back. Time travel, they do it all the time. That's fine with me. Maybe it'll be a hologram. I don't know.
Yeah, I know
they got those two. The idea, though, with Star Trek is that 50 years in, you can go anywhere. You can still take the series in a new direction. And in this case, you do it by going in an old direction. I just, you know, the films that...
That speaks to its universal appeal.
Yeah, and the malleability that we're willing to go wherever it wants to go. I mean, with Pegg, you know, he's already written 3 films with Edgar Wright that are rooted... You know, they're steeped in the past. Shaun of the Dead is all about horror movies and romantic comedies.
How many little Easter eggs are in that thing? Hey? Oh my goodness!
It's still my favorite of anything they've done together or separately. It's just such a perfect
movie. I love Simon Pegg. I think he's brilliant. I mean, he's extremely funny, but he's also brilliant.
Mm. Yeah, he's like sort of the nerd godhead at this point. You know, functioning in all of these franchises as our representative.
Yeah.
And making us feel like, I've said this a couple of times about Star Trek this year, it was the original It Gets Better, I think. You know, like in the 60s when everything was jockey and military, and it showed the bookish kids that there was a way forward, that maybe we were going to be okay and valued in the future. It mattered in the 70s when I was a kid growing.
Well, when this came up too, there's inclusion for everybody, like you said, the bookie, but everybody, there's no cultural boundaries. I mean, we're going to whole other worlds with other races and species, and
humanity's already gotten past the petty stuff by the time we catch up to it,
which is wonderful. I mean, how beautiful is that as a universal concept to engage in?
Be real nice.
Could be.
You know, this is going to drop the day of the US election, so it would be really nice if humanity could get over its petty bigotry by then.
I don't want to get into that.
It'll be over by the time most people hear this, I hope. Or all of civilization will have ended. Who can say? You know, the other thing that people forget about the Star Trek movies, and we talked about this in Hugh Gibson's episode, is that this is a future that's already suffered wars, and, you know, like there's the eugenics wars that they talked about in the TV series, and the World War III that they sort of mentioned in one of the movies. And finally, people are clawing their way back and still fighting amongst each other. But, you know, less. We have more priorities. We're looking outward instead of inward.
I think the fighting, though, is about moving forward than it is about holding on to pasts or rooting in silly, petty, simple things. It's more about fighting about how to move forward together, you know?
Yeah.
Can I tell you what the other movie was that I was going to maybe throw at you?
Sure, yeah.
And it's because it was, for me, the beginning of my interest in, I'd say sci-fi to an extent, but it was Blade Runner.
Okay. Yeah, no one's picked Blade Runner yet, actually.
Is that right?
Yeah, I've done like 90 of these.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Dang it, I should have picked Blade
Runner. the show breaks down really simply. People pick formative films, things that they've loved all their lives, or they pick the last thing they saw that really blew them away.
Right.
And I think that works too. Like, you know,
well, formatives for me would have been like Breakfast Club. And, you know, but I wanted to... That's before I was an actor. Like, okay. Breakfast Club, I wasn't an actor at the time, but I knew, like...
Did you know you wanted it? Did you, like...
Did I know I wanted to be an actor?
Did you feel that trajectory already?
Yeah. Performance, for sure. I mean, being a pro athlete, there was a performance element to it.
Sure.
But there's something else always back burner niggling at my brain about the performance, but not sports. It's something else. And it was... I tried comedy with my brother, and thank God he's funny. And then, yeah, and then it was... You know, acting. It had to be. It's funny to find it now. I look, but there's nothing else on the planet I want to do. And looking back at it, it was weird that I had to find it through the path I did. Because it is the one true passion, job wise, career wise, that I can't deny. Like, people say, what's your dream jobs? Name your top three dream jobs. I'm like, actor. Right. You know, there's... Because I get to be anything and everything anytime I... every day on set's a great day. That's my motto. I've probably said it 20 times today. But it is... That is just true.
Yeah.
Anytime I'm around, there's something to learn. There's an experience happening. And I see it as a gift. And storytelling. You know, tapping into universal truths. I like going to class. I now teach an audition class, so, and I take some of the scene study class and some of the classes that I've taken and try and inject them into audition class, which isn't, I mean, it's a lot deeper than you get normally in an audition class, but I think it's the core reason of why you should do what you do, why you should audition, is because you want to tap into a universal truth and tell a story in the most honest and connected way you can to take others on a journey. Mm-hmm. So, there
so
you go.
But was that always, is that how you've evolved to look at your drive now? I mean, was that always the reason?
As an actor, to be an actor.
Did you discover, is that what you loved about acting? Was it always what you loved?
The exploration, yeah. The absolutely. I love acting because of the self-exploration, but also the connection to the greater whole, the greater good, I guess. Because if I have to tell a story with where there's sadness, if I don't truthfully connect to that universal concept of sadness, why would you come with me?
Right.
You're not. You're not going to come with me unless I'm truly somewhere that has... Like, we all know when somebody's bullshitting.
Yep.
Right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And we've watched it. We've watched it like, oh, man, I'm not buying it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not... And that, I mean, it's hard. Nobody's there all the time. That would be... But that's the job. You want to aspire to be there as fully and completely as you can every opportunity you have. That's why you study and keep practicing at the one. But that's the goal, and that's the passion I have, is to be able to connect to those universal truths and tell stories in a way that engages others, and so that they enjoy that time spent watching.
Right. And with something like this, where you're under all of this makeup and creating a different physicality for yourself, do you find it easier or harder to access those parts because of the disguise that you've built?
I think it's a totally different skill set, and you know, I wasn't a big role at all in this film, but that doesn't change the process or approach. You bring whatever you're going to do to its fullest, and you do whatever. So I know that when I wound up interacting with Idris Elba on there, it wasn't like getting caught off guard or oh crap, because it did kind of happen somewhat organically, because his process is so amazing that he just wants everything available to find out where he's going to go. Mm-hmm. It didn't script that he comes over and does this and then does that, and then it's like he enters and here's the dialogue, but what he does with that, that's what's so phenomenal, is me hiding behind the makeup to watch this artist do his thing, is like, how do I sponge and learn, and what can I learn from this genius?
Yeah. Del Toro told me once that he had one long conversation with Elba early in the making of Pacific Rim, where it's like, okay, this is a great speech, but I'm probably not going to do all of it, so don't freak out. And he said it was, Del Toro said, it was great because I wasn't worried anymore. I wasn't worried that he'd miss a line or anything. He would just get there whenever, and we would use what we got. And then Elba said to me in a separate interview, he said, look, I can't see what I'm doing. I rely on the director to tell me if I'm close, which is like the single smartest thing any actor has ever told me or ever said to my knowledge.
Because it means he's there.
Yeah,
he's not separate and watching. He's not self-directing. He's there. Yeah. And then he comes back out and goes, did we?
Yeah.
Because I was fully engaged. I was fully there.
It's so weird that no one else seems to approach it that way. Like this total, as though he's sort of able to articulate the disconnect that he can create within himself to be someone else for a little window of time.
There's no ego left. There's no judgment. There's no self-dialogue or self-direction. Mm. There's just the doing. And I feel like it would come from the homework. Like, you do all that beforehand. So when you get there, you can throw it all away
right. And
be. Because you have to be.
Yeah.
You can't do. Doing doesn't tell the story. It's that you are being.
Yeah.
You're. You know? And so when he's doing his thing, if I hadn't done my homework and we had to walk and I knew that I felt like I had to protect everybody because I was the biggest and that, you know, then when he approached me, it might not have happened and he might not have decided to give me a smack in the head and put me back in my place. It might not have become what it became and given me that moment and that experience. So I can say I had a really great time on the set, regardless of how big or small the role was. I did my work. Idris Elba was a genius. Our paths got to cross and it ended up with a smack in the head, whatever. But it was a moment for me to go, hey, you know what? This proves to me that no matter what I'm doing, I fully engage, I fully do my job, I fully do my homework. And be grateful for it. And that might be extremely Canadian of me, but I never want to lose that, because that I feel is the drive and fuel for the passion.
Yeah.
Is to be grateful. Because if I stop being grateful, then don't do it. Because there's a billion people who want to and might do it better if they're engaged with full passion to do it.
Right.
Well, into that universal truth.
Yeah, the minute you tip over into entitlement.
Oh, I mean, that
word. I was going to say you're no good to anyone as a Canadian, but in general, yeah.
That word makes me twitch, because I feel like the youth have stumbled into a level of entitlement. Mm. That makes me sound like an old man.
Well, the world's always been there the way they think it's always been there, right? Like, it's, every generation thinks they invented sex and rebellion and punk and all of that. And it's like, guys, come on. You just get there eventually.
But if I can lump you in with me, our generation, there was an element of working hard and earning. You had to earn what you wanted. You had to work for it. You had to. And I feel like there's a lot of, well, I'm here, so I should just get.
Yeah.
Type attitude. Now, I don't want to get too far into that whole.
Well, no, it's funny that you mentioned.
I have kids, so I'm conscious of this.
Yeah,
now.
Exactly.
Normally, I'd be like, eh, whatever. That guy might be a douchebag just because he's a, you know. But now I'm trying to make sure I'm instilling in my kids. My dad did a great job in instilling. He was a workaholic, so I don't really want to go that far, because he was a powerhouse, a phenomenal. He's still with us, but he's a phenomenal man and just an absolute powerhouse. But he's retired, and. I believe that he's the one who taught me, and my brother and I used to always say this to each other: no matter what, get up one more time, then they knock you down, whoever they are. So whatever it is you choose to do, it's going to be a tough battle, but you have to work hard, you have to earn it. That doesn't mean you have to make it hard for yourself. I think some people go too far and make, you know, you're not allowed success unless you've suffered. Well, if you're really good at something and you work hard, you can be successful and it doesn't have to hurt.
Yeah, that's a pretty good philosophy, frankly. I mean, enjoy what you're doing and just don't stop.
Yeah.
Those are good rules. I don't know about the millennial, the expanding millennial gap, where the concept of, I don't know what it's so weird, because
I think that's like a little bit about the Transformers movies.
Yeah.
Just they have such an audience because there's like less attention to, I'm going to go back to the word connection.
Right.
You know, to feeling and earning and being present. It's more like, well, bring it to me and I'm entitled and all right, just spoon feed me that.
Yeah. I'd love to see a mumblecore Transformers movie, you know, like something like Cloverfield that's about the characters inside the world, because then at least I would care.
Yeah.
Maybe not for the whole movie, but I would start by being more interested than I am in the movies that I'm seeing.
That was Drew Goddard's, that was a neat twist.
Yeah.
On that genre.
Oh, that's right. That was the other thing I keep forgetting. You are actually you may be the first guest on the podcast who's been in a movie that's been covered on the podcast about a year ago.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, a year ago, someone picked Cabin in the Woods.
No way.
So technically, we're finally closing our own loop.
Oh, nice. Hey,
this may be the first time this has happened.
Yeah, it was the big bad zombie in there. Yeah. It was the main Matthew Bugner. I was actually telling somebody the other day, a little Easter egg from that was, if you look closely, my eyes are black. Mm-hmm. And everybody else in the family has cataract white eyes. And that's because I was the pure evil of the family and I killed the rest of them.
Oh, nice.
So they came back, but with white eyes, because they were killed by my evil and Matthew Buckner's evil, and his eyes are black because he is the start of the evil for that family. Uh-huh. But yeah, what a phenomenal experience that was. And I got to actually hang out with the quirky mad genius of Joss Whedon a few times at craft services and whatnot. And I was in a zombie makeup, which was pretty weird.
Yeah, I just, see, that's a set I would have loved to be on. That just seemed like the most fun.
It really was.
I got to talk to Goddard when he came through with it, but it's just, again, it's a movie that tells you what kind of movie it's going to be and then refuses to stand still and just keeps throwing more ideas at you. It's just so much fun and so odd and weird. And
when I try and dumb it down in terms of like what kind of movie it is, I say it's a horror comedy. Hmm. And I know that doesn't really cover it, but I love the fact that there's some levity and some beautiful comedic moments.
Yeah,
like when the stoner character says, when they're, you know, they're all infected by the gas, and he's like, we should all go separate directions. And the stoner guy, because he's high, he goes, really? You know, just this is, that's not, everybody in a horror dies when they, you know, like,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just acknowledging, like Seven Psychopaths does, that you know what kind of movie this is.
Yeah.
And I'm still going to screw with your
unapologetically
expectations.
Unapologetically going to screw with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was fun to be a part of that, too. And that was, there were some neat experiences with that. We had to do movement workshops on how to move like a zombie.
So what was the driving philosophy? What sort of zombie were they? I mean, is there, you know, did they break the rules down to you that specifically?
Well, we had like one of the coaches from
Dawn of the Dead versus running zombies and fast zombies.
Yeah, we talked about that. We definitely, like, when we discussed it, we discussed all the different types of, like the classic zombie and the 28 days later, fast, furious, angry, aggressive ones.
The
and
ones that Peg hates.
Yeah.
He's written about this in the, I think in The Guardian or The Independent, he wrote an essay about why fast zombies are crap. I'm inclined to agree.
Yeah, me too. I mean, he's a genius. Why should we? How can we?
Sorry, but you were saying, right?
No, not at all. And there was a dance instructor who taught us the zombie note, but we got to bring it to life in our own way because the Matthew Buckner character was a huge, big farm boy. Mm-hmm. And so his walk was going to have, and then we started talking about ailments, like if when we died, were we buried so that one leg was twisted slightly, and so for years, now that we've come back and reanimated, does that nag you, and how does it nag you?
Yeah.
And does it plague your walk? Or so there's a little neat twist, just to make it not, just so you're not going, hey, and you know.
Yeah, everybody has what they think a zombie is like.
Yeah,
and
but we got way
deeper. You can always tell.
So we got way deeper.
Oh, that's amazing. Zombie atrophy. I never really thought about it, but it does make sense.
Yeah, and then we also had the, because I had killed everyone, my younger brother in the movie, he was a little bit faster moving zombie because he was always worried about, when he died, he was worried about me coming to get him. Type thing. And then for me, I was very much more stoic and slow because I was the evil.
Right.
So everything I did was with purpose and control. Still a zombie, and they still had the element of being a zombie, but with stoic control. It was just, so again, layering in it, that, but that's the beauty of what I thought and hopefully brought to Wajet, is it wasn't just a dude in a mask or a guy in an outfit. There was a creature created, and there's some thought process behind it. So that if you do wind up on camera with Idris Elba, you're not going, "Oh my God, I'm a dude in a mask. I don't know what's going on." You know, I don't want
to. Yeah. That would be a great scene.
I'd do anything with Idris Elba.
He comes at you bellowing in the alien language, and you're just like, "Hey,
big security guard."
Aliens must have red shirts. The same principle has to apply.
Yeah, you're going to die. We did have there were some background aliens, and their makeups weren't as intense or long. They're more, you know, slip on. But
right, you've got like a hero head where they build the whole thing.
Yeah. There's like six, I think, different pieces to it. And like I said, it took 5 hours, which, and then an hour and a half to get it out. But some of the background ones, that you know, they hadn't been told or given the opportunity to know that they could play. So they were kind of just walking. And you're like, you have a giant fish head on your head.
Yeah.
You gotta look in the mirror and see what that does to you after you get over the awe of how amazing it looks. What does that do to you? And then start anything that comes to you, just let it be anything but human, because if you look in the mirror, you're not human.
Yeah.
And even that subtle, and there's some great people on set, and no, not knocking the extras, the fact that they would put on the makeup and it was hot and, you know, long days. But it came around, I said, okay, I need you to, you know, give me something different and stuff, because we're in that big long prison line walking down. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to have it like human with a weird head, human with a weird, you know, it had to be alien and different and unique. So they worked on all the details, and that's the beauty of a huge nine figure budget movie, is that they're doing one and a half, maybe two pages a day, so you can find all those little tidbits and fine tune the details.
Yeah.
So that
it's all world building, right? Like, it all matters.
I think so.
Even the detail of what kind of, like, to bring it back to Seven Psychopaths for a second, even the detail of what kind of a dog is being stolen.
Yeah.
Like, that Shih Tzu is a runner. It becomes a running gag.
Bijou's Shih Tzu, yeah.
So the
and it gives it, like, Rockwell, the way he says it, too. That's the beauty of character, is that, oh, my God, Rockwell, man.
Yeah.
Like, I know he chose, I don't think he specifically consciously went, I'm going to say it this way, but from the work and beauty of his instrument as an artist, that's what comes out.
Yeah, I think his decisions are, I'm pretty sure he does more work than he admits, because he has to. You would have to. You can't be that.
Or it's innate. Like, you know, like, he does the work without consciously knowing he's doing the work, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, maybe. Just the way the dialogue reads, by the time he's on set saying it, he's gone over it enough times that he's built the rhythms of it.
Because there's a subconscious processing of the world and the script and the character and his innate, amazing instrument that comes to life on the day.
Yeah, Walken, like, famously underlines different words randomly and then sees how that plays in a script. Which
I've also heard that he, I believe it's Christopher Walken, blacks out the other people's dialogue.
Oh, I could see that.
Or has it blacked out before it's brought to him, so he doesn't know what they're going to say or when they're finished.
So he'll just respond.
So he responds more naturally, more realistically, which is an interesting tool. And that's the thing about working with or hearing about other actors' process, is like, would that work for me? Could that enhance my process and my end product if I do that as well?
Yeah,
I found it very difficult when I tried it.
I would think, I mean,
but he does it. If it is Christopher Walken, and I apologize.
But if it's what you're used to by that point, I mean, by the time you're on set with people, you've probably figured it out in your own head how it's going to go.
Yeah.
Like, in terms of how you can deliver and where. But the idea, just walking in blind and not knowing, oh, I'd be terrified.
But it forces listening, right? Like, a huge part of acting is listening. And for him to not know what they're going to say forces him to listen intently.
Mm-hmm.
And that will make you a better actor immediately.
Yeah.
You know, listening is crucial. It's essential.
Yeah. I mean, you can always tell, I find, you can always tell when someone is waiting to talk. And you can always...
The bullshit meter.
Yeah, but you can also always tell when a movie has had to cut around, when a director or an editor have had to cut around someone who wasn't giving back.
Yeah, like, you cut to them and they're like, checked out.
Or you can see it sometimes, and it's really bizarre when that looms up about, you know, the eye lines might be matching or not matching, but the commitment or the connection is just not there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's the intoxicating, the euphoric drug I love when I act, is to be in a scene with somebody that you fall right into them. You go right through the windows of their soul, into their eyes, and you disappear into that scene, and you can't help but, you're present, and it's there and it's happening, and then cut, and then, I don't know, at the end of that, that's like the drug rush. There's a euphoric state that happens for me on those days.
Yeah.
And I've worked with some, it might be funny for people to hear this name because she was in such an iconic kind of pop show of 90210.
Mm-hmm.
But I just got to be a lead in a movie with Jenny Garth.
Okay.
And she would jokingly say, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. I don't want to act anymore. And jokingly, because she's so great. She's so gifted. But between action and cut, such an amazing experience for me.
Really?
To work with her, so present. Yeah, just, and it's happened a lot, but that was the most recent one that I can think of, where I'm just like, and our characters were getting divorced, so there's a whole bunch going on, and that you wouldn't honor the whole story if you didn't connect, because there's a whole world going on underneath.
Sure.
You're talking to each other.
That story alone, right? These characters have history.
There's a history that you can't deny, and if you're not looking, anyway, she was wonderful, wonderful to work with, so connected, so present, that it was that euphoric drug. At the end of the day, I go home, and it was a movie of the week. You know, people sometimes don't give them the credit they deserve, but I would drive home, and kind of have that half smile on my face like that. That was really fun. That's why I do this, is to have these moments and this feeling, this kind of euphoric rush from connecting to somebody. And that's, I guess, you know, we're going all around first, the connection, back to connection, plugging into somebody else or an emotion, or into an emotion through somebody else.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome.
No, that's so great. I'm glad that you can like feel that as vividly now, I assume, as you did when you started, but that there's a sense of, you know, entertaining joy that you're into it. It's,
well, even more so because I think I'm learning better how to play my instrument, and that's allowing me to find it more. I might have missed out. I might have been the blank slate on somebody else's other side of theirs because I wasn't aware of my instrument enough to connect, or I didn't have an end to that scene, I maybe wasn't as present and connected for them.
Okay.
So I think it's even more so now, because as much as that's fun for me to see in somebody else, I want to be that for other people. There's two sides. There's two people in, or more, in every scene.
Yeah. It does sort of bring us to the last question of the show, which is always the same, which is, what of Seven Psychopaths have you borrowed or stolen or incorporated into your own DNA as a performer?
Well, in watching their performances, they're an extremely brilliant example of no ego and no judgment. To deliver what they delivered in the unique world and the quirky kind of off-kilter, morally ambiguous at times world, there's unapologetic commitment to the character and the story to a level where you're no longer present. And I think it's paying tribute to, for me, the first time I watched it, Sam Rockwell, and his ability to become completely, and we talk about whether it's innate or how much work he says he does or doesn't do.
Yeah.
But I believe wholeheartedly in Sam Rockwell's character and where he's at and his state, frame of mind, his mental state, and his choices. I don't feel like he's making choices because they're cool or because they serve something. It's because that character's alive in front of me on screen and I'm watching it. And to do so, you have to be devoid of ego, like self. There's no judgment, there's no self-direction. It's completely present doing, or being, rather than doing. I mean, you can have a doing. You can be tying a shoe or carrying a dog or petting it. That's a doing.
Right.
But the being is based on all of the work and all the workings and goings on and the history and the story, that you've done all that homework and then you've let it go so that you can just be.
And ideally, someone will have given you that kind of dialogue.
You know? And ideally, you have that phenomenal dialogue to play with.
You'll have Martin McDonagh behind you, poking you.
Wouldn't that be a dream? From your lips to the universe and right back to here.
That is how podcasts work.
Cool.
See what happens.
Cool.
My thanks to Dan Payne, whom you can see under all that makeup in Star Trek Beyond, on Blu-ray, DVD, and on demand right now from Paramount Home Entertainment. Thanks also to Stephen Shin. He knows what he did. You can find Dan on Twitter at @actordanpayne, all one word, and you can find Seven Psychopaths on Blu-ray and DVD from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment and for sale or rental on iTunes and Google Play. Check it out. Oh, and look for my TIFF interview with Sam Rockwell and Christopher Walken at nowtoronto.com. I'll retweet it out of the Semcast account. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at the aforementioned Semcast, S-E-M-Cast. And on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. This week's call sign is, I Set the Car on Fire. Thanks for listening.